there. This is Eric Detweiler, an assistant director in the University of Texas at Austin's Digital Writing and Research Lab and a PhD candidate specializing in rhetoric here at UT. I'm here to take you back to 2014, specifically to bring you the first half of a two-part interview with Dr. Jody Shipka, who was the featured presenter at the Digital Writing and Research Lab's 2014 speaker series. During her visit, DWRL Assistant Director Stephen Lemieux sat down to conduct the following interview. This interview was originally published on the website of the Humanities, Arts, Science, and Technology Alliance and Collaboratory, Haystack for short. It was part of the final project of Haystack's 2013-14 Rhetoric and Composition Working Group, which included four members of the DWRL. That project was entitled Evocative Objects, a workbook on multimodal composition, including assignments, exercises, and further reading. And you can find it by visiting the Haystack website, haystac.org, and searching for Evocative Objects. Jody Shipka is an associate professor of English at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of the book Toward a Composition Made Whole. In that book, she makes the case for introducing more multimodal work into composition classes, from interpretive dances to cakes to essays written on ballet slippers. She also outlines a detailed framework for assigning and responding to such work. The theoretical and pedagogical concerns of Toward a Composition Made Whole are the focus of the first part of the interview. The second part, which focuses on the possibilities and challenges of multimodal scholarship, will be available soon via Zeugma's various streams. For now, let me turn things over to Dr. Shipka and Stephen Lemieux.
Thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you for inviting me.
Early on in Toward a Composition Made Whole, you note the sort of snarky responses your work with multimodal projects sometimes generates. As a way to speak to and anticipate such responses, are there any common objections or skeptical questions you'd like to address from the get-go?
I think they're still the same ones that I kind of talked about in the book. How is this writing? How is this academic? How does this prepare students? And, you know, questions about how does this translate into other classes? And I think one of the kind of misconceptions is this is a fringy kind of practice, whereas I see it as a very fundamental practice in terms of having students think more responsibly, more flexibly about rhetorical and material dimensions of all kinds of communicative practices, including but not limited to the academic. As I look at the practice, it all boils down to three questions. What is it? What work does it do? And what is it comprised of? And these are the questions that it comes back to time and time again when I'm composing my own work. What I'm advocating is not demonizing print. It's about allowing people to think about the options they have for responding and to make the most wise, appropriate decisions about that final representational form that they possibly can. And I see as fundamental to doing this work, these questions about what something is, what it's comprised of, and the kind of work it does. Certainly, you know, as I've said before, I don't anticipate that students will go on to other classes and compose on shirts or make games as arguments or compose on shoes. I would also suggest how often are they going to compose academic types of texts in other venues? You know, the same question could be made. So what I see is I'm having students ask questions that will transfer or translate into other domains of practice. So I think that's the way that I kind of address those questions about how is this academic, how does it prepare students? And I think that students leave my class having this repertoire of questions that allows them to situate themselves in new domains that might require things of them.
It sounds like maybe there hasn't been a shift in kind of the questions people have about your work since the book.
What's interesting in terms of those conversations, they haven't changed much in terms of the classroom. Students have the same questions for me. They don't even know I wrote a book. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't changed. But I think in terms of conversations in the field, my work has moved on. So at conferences and other talks, I'm talking about new work. It's not like it was when, from what, 2000 on, where I was presenting about this work. And I think then the questions were a lot of, what are you even doing? What are you teaching? assessment always has been. You know, how do you assess these things? We know how to assess this work, which I think is, you know, when we're talking about traditional work, we don't. We disagree. The same paper could get an A from one person, so why people were so confounded as to how I would grade these projects always, and I turned it around. How do you grade? What are you looking for in a traditional piece of work, right? So I think that in terms of what I'm hearing, I think that the shift in the questions, for me anyways, I feel like the book kind of stands as my statement. So it seems, and again, just based on the audiences with whom I've Skyped since the book has come out, there's more of a question about how, if somebody wants to do this, how do you justify it? Those questions come up, also questions that get to material concerns about this. I had a great question from a grad student who also worked as an adjunct, and she said, you know, I don't have a room, an office. How do I store the, you know, papers tend to be pretty tidy, and when you're getting things on computers, that becomes different. But if students are creating objects, how do, and my answer is you can't. You can't cart them all home. So what do you do? Say, you know, you can create object arguments, but they only have to be this big. So it seems like there are fewer questions about how do you assess this, or how does this tie in, because my book makes that argument, than there is about how do you justify this and how do you create programs that support this, seem to be the shift in questions.
No, that makes a lot of sense. We're here in the Digital Writing and Research Lab, but one of your arguments is that too much focus on the digital, conflation of terms like multimodal with multimedia or digital, or positioning digital and analog as pure opposites, can be limiting for both scholarship and pedagogy. What gets left out when we get too focused on the digital, and can stepping back from it help us learn something new about it, learn to return to digitally oriented projects with a reinvigorated perspective?
I think absolutely, and in terms of what gets left out when it's on paper or on the screen is quite simply a whole lot of other stuff. In terms of experiencing projects, what's left out is scent, texture, touch, moving those objects around in your hands, the taste of things. And I think about all of these potentials. You know, quite recently, one of my colleagues had a student turn in an argument as a cake. I've not received a cake since, I think, 1998. And so I was particularly jealous that, because I keep, you know, asking students, could you make an argument that's edible, that would just be served to people in that moment and through consuming it? And so I think, you know, when we're thinking about digital, you can't smell the products for the most part. Certainly in a digital setup, I could cue readers to, you know, as you're reading this piece of the argument, touch something that's very prickly, or, you know, smell this. But I think working with those artifacts, and you get it from paper, right? You get the touch and the scent. But I think in terms of a sensual experience, a lot gets left out when things are online. But in terms of composing things, and I make this point in the book, that we're still moving from one rectangle to another. We're moving from the page to the screen. And I think about all of the other options we have for materials to play a role in that argument. I've seen in particular students using materials to really advance or complicate an argument in a way that I don't think that they could do as well with words. I think that our options are severely limited when we are just thinking about these two rectangles. So I think that that's one part in terms of what using older technologies can teach us about the digital. I think it helps us think about what we take for granted. So for instance, in a course that I teach about theories of communication and technology, we start off, you know, right off the bat, composing with clay tablets. And this is only because I can't find a way to do what I really want to do without potentially setting the place on fire. But what I'd like to do is have students begin by making their own paper and ink. And to think about, all right, if you have something that's due in 2 weeks, when do you shop for the supplies for paper? When do you make it? How much do you need? What about the ink? How much do you need in order to do this? And people tend to think they're really good with calligraphy, and they're not. There'll be ink all over the place. I'm like this with bowling. I always think I'm a much better bowler than I am until I actually throw the first ball and realize, no, I don't score like 268 points. But I think moving to these older forms, typewriters, I was always curious to see how much of that would transfer in terms of the layout of the keys. People are used to keyboarding. But it's interesting just in terms of the demands put on your body for using the typewriter and having to push harder. And I remember at one point, somebody was looking at the typewriter I had in class and they said, well, there's no exclamation point. And to think then that, well, you would have to do the period and then do whatever, the I or the L in order to make that. So I think that what using some of these older forms make us see differently is kind of what's taken for granted, what's, and I think more and more our technologies have made things more efficient, but I also think beyond that, what is that dialogue? Are there ways that we can bring in some of the potentials of older media forms online? Is it possible to do that short of just digitizing things? With the new work I'm doing now, I'm working with primarily 8mm and 16mm film. So I'm really kind of aware of how finicky those things are. And I'm not to say that computers aren't too, but working with these forms that are so brittle and so old and are decomposing as I'm using them makes me think differently about other kinds of breakdowns and makes me think differently about some of the newer technologies that I use and how they position me, my body, my attitude, which things make me feel better in using them and what is the difference. So I think that there's a whole lot going back to the older media forms that can make us think about what we take for granted. With the clay tablets, for instance, what does erasing become? It's not that you can click on a whole passage and delete it. You have to flip it over, rub it out. And so I think it's a really helpful thing in moving then to the digital and the difference it makes to do that work versus using older media forms.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Having students begin to construct the things that they'll actually use to write. I like that. In Toward a Composition Made Whole, you take up what you call mediated action as a way of framing our understanding of final products. This comes out in your students' work, especially in the statements of goals and choices that you have them produce. Is it possible to produce texts that demand that a reader take them up within this framework, that call attention to their richly mediated production?
I think, definitely, in terms of, I mean, in the book itself, I say that we have to adopt a unit of analysis that is looking at individuals always using, whether it's psychological or technical tools, that we don't lose sight of the process, that body and movement, and what that body is using in terms of the environment, in terms of the tools, in terms of language. And I think students in my course are trained to look at things that way, to think about how the human and the non-human come together in an oftentimes very awkward dance of dominance, you know, that the student wants to do something but can't afford the means to do it. Or I remember in one instance, a woman had taken photos of everybody in the class for a project. And this was, she was shooting film at the time, had taken the film to be developed at a Walgreens, and the person lost or destroyed all of her film. And she saw this as a problem. I saw it as an opportunity, again, to think about what happens then. You know, what are your options? Do you go with a totally other approach to the assignment? Do you make that? Do you foreground that breakdown in your work? Which I'm always a fan of doing. And certainly with my new work, it's much more about foregrounding those breakdowns. And, you know, the student's response, she wanted to cover over it and take pictures again. So I think in having students think a lot about the human and non-human coming together, I think particularly when students opt not to write a traditional form, a traditional paper, I think it absolutely positions readers or people who interact with these projects in that way. I think when you get the ballet shoes, or when you get the video game, when you get Muffy's dance, for instance, it does become, I remember when that dance started going, you know, I could see right there what it's comprised of. All these people I don't know walking into my classroom, there's music, we're standing up against the board. But it, you know, it took me a while to go, oh, okay, it's a dance. And then as I watched the component pieces, it became, I was able to craft that. What is it? It's us. It's a dance that is us. And so I think that particularly with this kind of work that doesn't look, sound, or behave in ways that we've come to expect academic work to do, I think it very much positions people to be able to come back to these questions of what work does it do. One of the questions that comes to mind is, how does it do academic work? Because it doesn't look that way. So I think even more so than probably students composing these things, which after a time it becomes, well, this is what you do, and I'm using mirrors because I want to make this argument. But for the person outside of the class, for the reader of these texts, oftentimes it is that sense of, okay, what's going on here? And when something looks different, you tend to start naming the parts in order to put together some kind of a hypothesis of what it is and what work it does. So I feel that particularly in terms of other people coming upon this, and I remember as a interesting story, as a grad student, I was obviously doing this work, so my office was filled with different types of three-dimensional arguments. And at one time, I started mentoring somebody else in the program as a grad student to do this work. And all of a sudden, I'd come into the office and go, is it a chair or is it a piece of student work? And it really became that way of looking at the objects differently. And I have a colleague now at UMBC who does similar kinds of work. So I'll go into her office and go, is it a Marie Antoinette head or a lamp? I mean, and so it does really become a way of looking at and anticipating the materiality of arguments. Or even to think now, you know, more often from doing this for so long and seeing all of the great ways. I mean, I could not take my class. I don't necessarily think with objects in that way. I think in linear, more traditional forms of academic text. But having seen all of this great work since about 1998, I do find myself looking at the world and seeing potentials in garbage, in things I wouldn't necessarily, to go like, oh, this would be, I'll bet you if I picked this up, somebody I know would be able to do something really cool with this.
Yeah. So let's see, this next question, it kind of gets back to kind of responses to your work, mm-hmm. About kind of the push toward non-humans or post-human kind of scholarship.
I mean, I think, again, the emphasis on tool-mediated behavior that it, and you know, through Vygotsky, Warsh, and Latour, to think about the human and non-human together. So I think it's always been aligned in that post-humanist tradition, even though I don't necessarily name it in that particular way. So I think that there are links there definitely, so.
Yeah. Throughout your book, you spend a lot of time focusing on a few projects that your students have done. You mentioned Muffy's dance project, or if you'd like to highlight more recent student work, another project that exemplifies this sort of multimodal work and its possibilities.
I think, you know, where Muffy's work really stood out for me is I knew I wanted to write about it, and I knew that I wanted to tell her story, but it was probably the first time that I really struggled with the question, where is the writing here? Certainly as I interviewed her and it became very clear, I think that was a moment I knew I wanted to tell this story, where this was a woman who, as she represented herself, was so shut down as a writer, but could create these excellent arguments using dance, using bodies. And throughout the interview, you know, as she would say, oh, well, you know, everybody had a different solo. And I would say, well, what is a solo? And, you know, and I realized that the solo did function very much like a paragraph. And so I was seeing a lot of these kind of writer-like moves in her work. And at the time, in that context, I was teaching classes that required students to do a certain amount of writing. And here I'm thinking, you know, as a warning to everybody about the way we think about and teach writing, that we don't want to end up silencing somebody like Muffy. And I think she was silenced to begin with because for her, is her understanding, writing was all about these really bizarre rules. Is this spelled correctly? Is this punctuated correctly? That she wasn't even getting to the idea of what she wanted to do. And to see a woman who went from writing alphabetic prose and needing somebody next to her the whole time saying, when she would say, is this right, to directing them in this dance, in this argument about body language, that it was just, you know, so amazing. And I think at the time I knew that skeptics would say, well, you know, we're not teaching dance. How is this writing? Where does this connect to writing? That when I started thinking about and asking Muffy about all of the forms of writing and speech as well, that that were needed in order to pull this off. I saw that there was writing happening all around. Writing wasn't the thing in her case, but writing supported that thing. And I think that that was a moment, a kind of shift in my way of thinking about writing and our focus just on writing as the thing, as opposed to all of the other things that inform a final text, whether that's a dance, whether that's something that's written. So that was a crucial story, and I think I could have selected amongst many pieces of student work for that chapter, and I think I chose Muffy because it's a great story, it's a great piece of work, but also to get to that question, to say, do we want to continue to just think about writing in this very narrow final product way, or to expand it in that way? And I think, again, since I've been receiving this kind of work since 1998, there aren't necessarily, there's always, you know, within a semester or a class, real standout pieces. But I think what I'm noticing across the board, and perhaps because I'm pushing it more, is the final question that I ask, and this will, you know, get to the post-humanist orientation, but asking students to really think about who and what participants, human and non-human, immediate, in the past, in the future, play a role in shaping what they do. And because I've been pushing a little bit more, you know, for a while students would say, well, nobody really helped me, I did it. That in pushing them to think more about their composing process for a particular piece, that I've really seen students getting much more savvy with this. And I recently, and I brought it, a piece of student work where he breaks down that last question on the statement, and again, the question is, who or what played a role in helping you accomplish this work? And with this man, he broke down his acknowledgement into categories of human, material, and contextual. This was not anything that I had prompted. To give people a sense of what roles humans played, it was his girlfriend, for being patient with him, for listening to him as he was freaking out about creating this object-based argument. He also thanks classmates for feedback that they gave in class. He also thanks members of his group presentation group, because they would get together to discuss the group presentation and would continue to talk about the ideas there. Oh, and he also acknowledges the role that the authors of sample work that I shared with them, stuff that's housed on my website, that they played a role in his, even though they were people he had never met, played a role in shaping what he did. Interestingly, he looks back, and this gets to kind of the argument that he was making in this piece, but he acknowledges the admissions officers at the different colleges he visited before deciding on UMBC, who ended up telling him that being an undecided student was a great thing. And this is something he takes on in his argument about, you know, the constraints and affordances of being undecided as a student. He also thanks the guy from the printing center who helped him print up this work so he could do it. In terms of material, he covers computers, software, templates found on the internet that helped him design his piece. He also thanks, you know, tools, or he acknowledges tools like glue and tape and binder clips. He also acknowledges the task sheet that I gave him, the Blackboard discussion forum, and then using Tumblr as a kind of break from work. He finally has a long list of all the clip art that he had used. And then what's interesting, because I've not seen people make this move, even though I invite them to talk about the spaces in which they worked and how they played a role in shaping what they did or limiting what they did. But in this case, Jamie picks up on these contextual factors. One of them is acknowledging that had he not been enrolled in my particular section of this course, he wouldn't have been asked to do this or to think this way. But the other thing, he talks about the difference it made to have gone home for a while, where he didn't have the distractions of school, and so he was able to work on this more efficiently. And so it's really interesting to see students really thinking about the messy, what I call the messy dance of communication or of making arguments, making stuff. So it's beyond just that, well, nobody really helped me, I thought about what I was gonna do and my hands put it together. That to have them think about processes of composing, and it doesn't matter that it's an object argument, these same kind of questions could be answered for any form of work, you know, who or what played a role in doing this. So that's one change that I've seen and that I'm particularly happy with, and again, that I'm spending more time kind of breaking this down for them. And the other thing I think that I'm coming to appreciate is the way that students are able to use materials in ways that advance or support or complicate an argument in ways that perhaps I wasn't attending to as closely as I was at the beginning, where it was just a matter of, you know, what is it, how do I grade it, how do I assess it. But I've noticed lately a lot of people working with mirrors in their work, and this is really interesting in terms of what it means to be reading a piece and seeing yourself reading it. So it's kind of a way of, I think of it almost as a variation on the second person address, right? They're not saying in their argument, how do you feel about things? But as they're making their argument and I'm seeing myself strategically and through small mirrors or bigger mirrors or foil, that it's that reflection of me as a reader being part of this piece, making sense of this piece. Oftentimes they'll use materials in two or three ways. I had a person who was making an argument about the way identity is shaped and reshaped depending on the kind of context you're in or the influence you have. And the way that she was articulating this through materials is to use one of those small solar dancing plants. And she created a package that had all these different light sources. So the idea is you would buy this argument and you would plug in the different lights to see the impact that they had on this identity or this moving figure. And at the time, she's turning in a project with all these light bulbs, and she knew, I can't have them break. So inside, she ended up doing a kind of cloud scene. So aesthetically, it was beautiful and fitting, but she chose to use cotton balls as clouds in there as a way of making sure that the lights didn't break. So just a really interesting way of saying, you know, the clouds, or the cotton in this case, contribute in this way for my argument, but they also serve a very functional packing or protection function as well. So I think that's been something where I give these projects back and more I'm going like, you know, they're not just using materials to use them or because they like them. They're really thinking about the different potentials for meaning these things have.
Nice. You had mentioned kind of in, what would you call it, almost the student's thank you list?
The acknowledgments.
The acknowledgments.
Yeah.
The difference between, say, thanking or acknowledging versus citing, where it seems like it would be possible to cite all the things that he was thanking, but that he's actually thanking them, it throws an interesting twist on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the actual thing, does he distinguish between thanks and just acknowledgments? Because I could imagine some situations where you might acknowledge something
yes.
that happened, but you wouldn't want to thank it.
Yes, and that's why I try and make people, or I try and use a language, who or what played a role in you accomplishing this. Because again, getting to the idea of, you know, Deb Brandt's sponsors of literacy, some sponsors are negative. So with the admissions officer, and Jamie in this case calls them acknowledgments. So he's acknowledging the role something played, but sometimes it's absolutely horrible.
Mm-hmm.
As the admission officers served as a kind of inspiration, but it was a negative experience. So in that way, I want students to think about the role that, you know, the teacher who said that you wouldn't ever be able to write or you wouldn't be able to amount to anything, if that person's in your head, and to think not just about the things that were present at the time of composing, but the things that we carry forward with us, habits, practices from the past. And, you know, I think in Jamie's case, he does a really good job of breaking these things down into different categories, but he does, with the clip art in particular, that ends up looking like a citation because he's got the actual link. And I hadn't thought about kind of the connection between citations. I really looked at this more as that scrolling list of credits at the end of the movie, who did what, but to, you know, again, have people as much as they can to articulate, and I have to do this in my own work, to be able to talk about the role that Instagram played or that a certain app played, to really break that down. And when you start itemizing all of the things that play a role in your process, the list could be endless, right? But I do think, as you said, it's important to bring in those disruptions, right? And it's not just who do I want to thank, but who do I want to acknowledge as having some kind of an impact on the work that I did, for good or for bad, or that totally changes, you know, where you're going with the project.
You mentioned how kind of students surprise you with the way they use materials.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get these different projects, do you find that your method of assessment has to change at all, or do they push your method of assessment further?
Again, you know, I've been asking for a variation on the statement of goals and choices since probably at least 99 or 2000. So my assessment practices haven't changed a whole lot. What has changed and what continues to change is my thinking about approaches to problem solving. You know, because again, with the assignments that I give, it's not a step list of what you need to do. It's more a matter of, here's a problem you have to solve, this is what it must contain, and those are non-negotiable. But it's interesting in terms of students' breakdowns, their confusion. I always get very worried when nobody has anything to ask or say about something, because when I can see where they're getting stuck, I can refine things a little bit. I think that student work has pushed me, not in terms of assessing their work. What's changed is when students end up creating a response to an assignment that I'm not seeing how it's my assignment anymore. They've managed to do what I've asked them to do, but take it in a different direction that allows me then to morph the assignment, to change the assignment. So it's almost like, rather than my assessment, what this work is changing is my awareness of potentials for communicating, potentials for using things in a certain way. I'm just amazed. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous where it's like, I've never seen anybody use glue like that before. You know, I mean, and it sounds so incredibly crazy, but I think there are all of those analog literacies that people don't have. Like, you know, how great are you with working with Play-Doh? How can you shape things, right? It might not be something that you have, but so I think mainly it's a matter of seeing this work and, as always, being able to appreciate, you can do that. You can make an argument. Oh my God, you know, when you make an argument that way, it means so differently, and it has such a different impact. And I'm always asking students, what difference would it make to, again, change one of these variables, to have a different audience, take something three-dimensional online, to take something that's a performance and write that up? What would be gained and what would be lost throughout this? Yeah, I think it continues, even though I'll see there are certain things that become kind of the five-paragraph essay answer to these, where people go, oh, I'm going to do a scrapbook, or I'm going to do a PowerPoint. PowerPoint seems to be the new thing. Like, I can just do it. It's multimodal, and I don't have to think about the choices. But, you know, when I see a scrapbook done in a way that I haven't seen it done before, or PowerPoint, I think those are the moments to go, oh. And then I can take those things as examples, talk to them about other students, and see what they're doing. Again, scaffolding that based on the things I've seen and the things that I've learned about people's processes.
That's it for the first half of this interview. Thanks for tuning in. Check back for the second half later on this summer. In the meantime, if you're interested in more from Zeugma, you can follow us on Twitter at Zeugma Podcast, like us on Facebook, or check out our website, zeugma.dwrl.utexas.edu. This is Eric Detweiler. Thanks again for listening.